The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody, and thanks very much for joining me for this episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, today we're going into Climate Matters number 133, and you may recall that Climate Matters is now coming out on Substack rather than the old PDF version. That has a bonus for listeners of this show, because we can now link in the webpage on the Fresh FM website, we can link to the Climate Matters Substack posts. And so, just in case you want to just write it down, Climate Matters NZ, all one word, climatematters.substack.com will land you on our homepage. We will also put up a link directly to each issue that we are reporting on. So this time, we're going to Climate Matters number 133, and it's an energy-focused Climate Matters. It's going to deal with energy craving causing ecological, geopolitical, and seismic risk on steroids. We're going to have a look at the big grid blackout they had in Spain a few weeks ago. Then there's a case of overcomplexity. You'll have to wait and see what that is. Space junk and climate interact. And then New Zealand's first grid-scale battery, and then a final revisiting Rod Carr's valedictory. You may remember a recent Climate Matters, I did revisit what I called his valedictory at the Agriculture and Climate Conference, and now I've had a challenge on that, so we're revisiting it again. Additionally, it's 3 years since this show ran a series of podcasts in the run-up to the last local government elections. We had 16 outstanding guests on a series of roughly 20, 25-minute podcasts. We won't be re-interviewing them, but most of them are very relevant this time around as well. So we'll also put up a link to that. And if I get time, I'll run through a little bit more on that. But I have a hunch we're going to run out of time today. We have a fairly full show, and we'll just see how we get on. So as I mentioned, Climate Matters number 133 starts with a cartoon, and it's by the wonderful German cartoonist Ralph Ruter, and it's got a new arrival just come through the pearly gates and is standing on a cloud talking to God, and he's saying, "Oh, underfloor heating?" And the answer is, "No, global warming." Anyway, if there's an underlying message in this mix, as I mentioned, it's energy-focused, and that we should also be aware or be beware of first impressions. Just like the above new arrival in heaven, a "wow, this is cool" reaction often indicates a narrow boundary thinking. From the biggest ever hydro scheme to Skylink, let's be cautious. So the first one, energy craving is causing ecological, geopolitical, and seismic risks on steroids. Right. What's that about? And here's what I've said in Climate Matters. Our willingness to court disaster shows our insatiable craving for energy. China's remote Yalong Tsangpo Gorge is, wait for this, the greatest on Earth. It's as long as the Grand Canyon. It's three times the depth, and it's about to be the site of the world's biggest ever single infrastructure project. Two dams will generate 60,000 megawatts. Currently, the biggest dam is also in China, the Three Gorges Dam. It generates 20,000 megawatts. New Zealand's Benmore Hydro generates 400 and something. Anyway, Yale E360, we'll give a link to that on the Climate Matters webpage. Yale E360 did a deep dive into that, and it's a terrible thing. It's going to be flooded, but it's rated as, and I'm quoting, one of the most precious biodiversity hotspots on the planet. And in addition, it has the world's richest assemblage of large carnivores, and especially big cats. Who'd have thought that? I wouldn't have ever thought that in China. But to top that off, it's going to disrupt about 45% of the sedimentation of India's mighty Brahmaputra River, because the river that goes through China is called the Yalong Tsangpo. When it becomes in India, it becomes the Brahmaputra. But India's main worry is geopolitical, with fears that China may weaponize the river, and they're even considering building their own dam as a buffer against the deliberate release of what the article describes as water bombs, to say nothing of possible catastrophic failure, because it's exactly in the region that has the world's largest ever recorded earthquake. So that's a whole stack of problems, isn't it? Here's a quote from Tim Morgan, the energy economist at Surplus Energy Economics. I've often quoted him, and it relates to our energy hunger. Our almost limitless ability to create money does not enable us to drive a correspondingly limitless increase in the material side of the exchange equation. Energy and resources cannot be loaned into existence by the banking system or conjured out of the ether by central bankers. That's from Surplus Energy Economics 302. Right, I think we all remember Spain's blackout a few weeks back. And here's a bit of an ironic story. After weeks of investigation, the jury still seems out as to why the entire grid on the Iberian Peninsula lost electric power at 12:33 on the 28th of April. There are a huge range of reasons being put forward, and they range from a lack of flywheels to synchronize all the solar farms with the grid, to a substation failure in Granada, causing, as they said, a chain of grid disconnections. And then also there was a detection of a very strange cyclic oscillation in the grids across the whole of Europe just before shutdown. And the actual Climate Matters, if you follow the link to the Substack, you'll see a strange wave pattern that shows two lots of oscillation, one in Spain and the other 3,500 kilometers away in Latvia, both in sync. So whatever the trigger, the cascade of events was terrible, from France disconnecting from Spain to an unprecedented series of solar shutdowns. And in essence, it brought 60 million people in Spain and Portugal and even a corner of France to a standstill. But there's still no conclusive public explanation, in spite of astonishing levels of expertise, suggests to me that it's such a complex system at so many levels that it may be impossible to predict or avert every damaging combination of circumstances. In this era, when electrify everything is something of a catch cry, and with a gentailer system in New Zealand not proven to work in the country's best interests, are the critical lessons for New Zealand Inc. in this, I'm asking? As a long, thin country prone to earthquakes and with high dependency on the Cook Strait cable, have we really done the risk analysis merited to underpin our ever-increasing electrical dependency? We'll give links to more reading at Carbon Brief and The Conversation if you want to follow that further. Here's a quote from Pedro Prieto, who was interviewed by Nate Hagans on The Great Simplification 176. We are very confident our network will never stop. People do not realize that it may happen so fast. He is a specialist in energy resources. Okay, here's a little bit from the Can You Believe It files, The Climate Crisis and Space Junk Interact. Couple of great diagrams there, which I won't try and explain, but they are taken from Starlink's imagery of all of their little satellites, And I didn't realize they've got 6,500 of them. Anyway, in a weird feedback loop, space junk is burning up in the upper atmosphere, as it's expected to. But that's multiplied tenfold in just 5 years, and it's heading for 4,000 tons per year early next decade. It's huge. I mean, 4,000 tons doesn't sound a lot in a lump of rock, but if it's a thin layer spread through the atmosphere, it's huge. This junk largely vaporizes to what they call space ash, with the potential to add or maybe subtract from global warming. There's a bit of debate about which bits of it will do what. But climate change has also adjusted the gases at very high altitudes. So get this. That results in lower density of atmosphere. That means there's a little bit less drag on the satellites screaming around, resulting in the junk staying up longer and potentially overcrowding space, I've called it, that bit of space. Not hard to believe when you look at the images that show just a few of Starlink's 6,500 satellites, when in fact there are over 10,000 altogether up there. And there's a couple of maps, so you'll have to go on, follow the link to the Substack if you want to see that. Here's a hotter tip for a cooler planet. I put this one up at the start of most winters. Put on a jersey or a jacket before you put on a heater. Just to put that in context, New Zealand's grid average emissions, that is the average that we get from using power on the grid, is about 125 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour. What that means is that if we put on a 2-kilowatt heater for an hour, that would cause about 250 grams of carbon dioxide emissions. That's enough to prevent about 1 kilogram of sea ice forming in the Antarctic. And reducing sea ice is a huge, in capitals, problem, slowing the critical deep ocean circulation that the whole of global ecosystems depend on. Every time we put on a heater, we're actually exacerbating that problem. Right, moving on. New Zealand's first grid-scale battery comes online. And that has come online in Northland, where Meridian has activated a 200 megawatt-hour battery, and it'll soon be joined by a major solar farm alongside it. In fact, they're all in the location of the old Marsden Point refinery. It cost $186 million, so it's a serious project. It's essentially a stack of, about 40 containers full of batteries. And that's enough to run half of Northland's homes for 2 hours. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but as a tool for easing generation at peak demand times, it can be significant. Let's just put this in scale out of fun. I worked out how long this huge Yarlung Tsangpo Gorge dam project would take. And if it was going full bore, it would charge this whole battery complex in 10 seconds. That's, of course, if the gear could handle it, which it wouldn't be able to. The name of the game of storing electricity in a battery and then releasing it again, buying it at a cheaper rate and selling it back at a higher one, is what's known as arbitraging. We covered that as a quiz question in Climate Matters 128. To give a feel, I calculated the variation in price, which is about $180 per megawatt hour. And then I assumed that if half of it was operating at half capacity, this system would return about $9,000 a day. Over 300 days a year, that's $2.7 million. And that's not a very big return on $180 million. So I'm saying it needs to work a bit harder. But another thing is, as Northland has some of the highest electricity prices and the poorest communities, Meridian was asked if this would help lower prices. They gave a very cagey answer. Every new generation project puts downward pressure on prices, they said. Let's hope the Northland community sees something more tangible than that. Right, revisiting Rod Carr's valedictory. And in Climate Matters 132, which is just the last one, I wrote that Rod Carr, quotes, knew his stuff, had nothing to lose, and hit nail after nail right on the head. A reader, Mike, from Wellington, clearly didn't think Carr had hit every nail on the head, and he emailed me, "I'm grumpy about your latest climate matters. Carr knows his stuff." In particular, he thought Rod Carr had not hit the energy and planetary boundary nails very well at all. Quoting again from Mike, "But everything in modern life, especially renewable energy infrastructure, is made from fossil fuels. Look around and see anything not made from oil." Well, firstly, a big thanks to Mike for challenging me on such a critical matter. Energy is pretty well party central when it comes to climate issues, or pretty well anything else for that matter. And the climate crisis is bad enough on its own, but it's just one element in the even greater issue of planetary overshoot. We've given a diagram and a link there on planetary boundaries. And so the thing there is, Mike's point illustrates it yet again, the importance of truly wide boundaries thinking, or systems thinking, if you like to call it, or an ecological system. An ecosystem thinking. So I'll have a go at tackling that. I still think Rod Carr's talk, and there's a link to it, is outstanding, and we must be careful not to take his comments out of context. So, for example, he was saying we know how to tackle 80% of the 80% of emissions from fossil fuels. He wasn't saying we know how to tackle 100% of them. However, I've got more to say about that. Having said that, I think Mike in turn has hit a whopping nail on the head and reopened a discussion we desperately need to keep going. In a way, his point is that it's not a question of taking Carr's comments out of context, but of seeing them in a much wider context again, i.e. with wider boundary thinking. And seeing it in that much wider context highlights the folly of keeping our foot to the floor on our present social and economic trajectory. And I'm reminded of a quote that I've given to you before from a Hart Hagen environmental journalist, not to be confused with Nate Hagens, who's also a commentator we quote. Hart Hagen, a couple of years ago, posted a post, and one of his quotes was, "A species that causes the extinction of 150 species a day does not need more energy to do more of the same." And in fact, I was so stunned when I read that that I did my own due diligence, and that number of 150 species a day going extinct is roughly the middle of quite a wide range from all sorts of authoritative sources, such as the World Wildlife Fund. Climate Matters has often championed the need to aim for a much lower energy future, not one that just keeps cranking at present energy levels, only using what we like to call renewables. And here are some of the reasons. The very feeble energy return on energy invested, or energy cost of energy of renewables, struggles to sustain energy-intensive societies like ours. I could do a deep dive into that, but I'm not going to. Our so-called renewables still cause emissions, from actually producing the infrastructure to its ongoing operation. Pursuing many renewable energy sources will actually have massive unintended consequences. For example, just Climate Matters 132 discussed production of palm kernel oil, which is responsible for wrecking vast swathes of tropical forest. The appalling consequences of our ecological brutal economies, we're trashing our only home with energy and resource-hungry processes that are largely geared to satisfying and even expanding our so-called lifestyles. If we're doing dumb things like deforestation, they are still dumb even if we use renewable energy for the chainsaws. So a core thrust of Mike's argument to me is that, without saying so explicitly, he frames Rod Carr's comments as geared to keeping our present destructive society charging ahead at its current rate, but with different energy sources. And therein lies a trap we fall into too often. To rephrase the comment I just made, if we're doing dumb things, they are still dumb, even if we use renewable energy to do them. So thanks again to Mike. I think we're all the better for his challenge. And that basically brings us to the end of the scripted part. I've got a couple of minutes, so I'm going to pull up my Climate Matters webpage with the interviews from 3 years ago. So anyway, 3 years ago, I had a very ambitious project to interview all the mayoral candidates in Nelson and Tasman, and then to interview, originally I thought, 4 climate specialists and then a local panel to get their take. I was overwhelmed by the generous response of a huge number of specialists, and we wound up doing 16 interviews with specialists, plus half a dozen with mayoral candidates, plus a program on with a panel putting their views. Just to recap, and you'll find all of these on the Resilience website under podcasts, climate and councils. Anyway, I'll skip the mayoral candidates because that was last time. But here are the people that we wound up talking to. We talked to Professor Susan Crumdyke, as Professor of Energy Transition at Heriot Watts University in Scotland. We talked to then Climate Minister James Shaw. We talked to Dr. Olivia Hyatt, who's a local specialist in human dimensions of climate change and on catchment ecology. We had the privilege of talking with Mirjana Stevens, the director of Whakatu Incorporation. Penny Molnar and Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara shared a slot. They were both talking on a just transition. We had two Simons, Simon Stewart, freshwater ecologist, and Simon Miller, the executive director of Pure Advantage, and they were talking about regenerating nature. We had the late Rod Oram and Ali Boswick talking about making our regional economy less vulnerable to climate. Sam Archer of the Green Building Council and Professor Rafe Chapman on climate, buildings and transport. Emeritus Professor Pat Bodger on our energy future. Professor James Renwick and Sophie Hanford on visualizing the future. And then we capped it off with Professor Bronwyn Hayward summing up what does all this mean. What a lineup that is. So that it's actually, there's a lot there, but I really encourage you to have a bit of a look. Okay, so that's us wrapping up for this week. Thanks so much for your company. Of course, you know that we're on Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station, and it broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.net. Oh no, now on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz and through the accessmedia.nz app. And so on that note, that's me thanking you again for your company. I do hope I enjoy it again next week, and kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.